history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that just need to be told, and we never hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen as we honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to make sure we preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Like the one we're going to hear today in Seattle, Washington, from a guy who's lived here almost all of his 97 years. Al Skerritt is our guest, and it's a good thing he made it to 97, because something has happened in the last year that was pretty unbelievable. We're going to hear about that. But let's start out early on. You were actually not born in the United States. You're born in Canada, in Alberta, with four siblings?
Five kids, and my dad came down. He got a job building the St. Vincent home as a carpenter. So when he got enough money, well, then he sent for my mother to come down, and she came down on the train with five children. I remember getting off the train. I was fussy, and my mother gave me a pillow to carry, and that kind of settled me down. We moved to West Seattle, and my dad rented a house just below the junction at California and Alaska Street. I took a look at that house. My gosh, it looked like a mansion because I came from a little small house on the prairie in Canada. Anyway, I moved up on 35th and Myrtle Street. I went to ECU school, and I had to walk to school. We didn't have buses in those days. And one of the neat things that happened to me, I walked by the fire station, and all the firemen knew me because I walked by their station every day. But I never knew I was going to be a firefighter myself. But these firemen always treated me good, and then I got a paper route delivering the Seattle Star. I delivered it to the fire station. I had to collect money from them, and I'm not sure just what it cost a month, but it was right around $1 a month. The firemen all knew me because my dog would come up at a certain time and sit on the corner waiting for me to show up, and I don't know how they knew the time, dog, but it was there every day for me, and he knew my route. I'd follow my dog instead of him following me. But it was really something, living up on the hill. And one day at school, we heard that Old Ironsides was coming to Seattle. This other kid, Earl Vance, and I, we climbed up to the top of the water tank where the ball is up there to see if we could see Old Ironsides come into Seattle. Of course, we couldn't see it, so then we climbed down again, but it was a dangerous thing that we did. We climbed clear up to the very top where the ball is.
And I'm curious, too, about your childhood. With a big family like that, with you and four siblings, and your parents had actually come to Canada from Norway, were you speaking Norwegian in the home growing up as much as English, or did you learn a little bit?
No, I just knew probably a few words. They didn't try to teach me Norwegian.
Do you remember those childhood years having a dream, an ambition, a thought, hey, when I grow up, here's what I want to do and here's what I want to be?
No, I was just good at doing whatever came up. I could always make things, and I was just born with the ability to do things.
So you get on into high school. Were you playing sports in high school, or were you too busy working for that? What were you doing?
Well, I turned out for football, and before I got the job of being a football player, freshman team, well, I got a job in a drugstore after school. So I quit sports, and I worked 4 years in this drugstore, and I earned 30 cents an hour. It was one of the best educations I ever had, because people would come in and ask me for the different things, and I kind of learned where they were. And the druggist really trusted me very much when I got to know the drugstore good. And when he would go out to lunch or something, well, he'd give me a phone number to call if I needed help or if somebody came to get a prescription filled. But it was really something. Here I was just 16 years old. I was in charge of a drugstore. It is kind of nice to be nice looking, and I guess I was, because the girls did like me. And I remember one day I was out in the park, Hiawatha Park. It's across the street from the high school. It was lunchtime. I was laying on a lawn with this girl, and I had my head in her lap. And she was playing with my hair, and I thought, well, she likes my wavy hair. When I went back to botany class, well, the kids were pointing at me and laughing. I didn't know what this laughing about. They said, well, put your hand on your head. And I did that, and here this girl had bobby pinned all my waves. And that's why the kids were kind of laughing at me. But I didn't know. I thought she was just admiring my waves in my hair.
She pulled one over on you. You know, and it's, for a lot of people, they think of Seattle, and some of the first things that come to mind, you know, would be the Space Needle, or the Seahawks, or the Mariners. None of that was here when you were growing up. During the Great Depression, did you feel the depression here in Seattle? Were you aware that things weren't as they should be?
Yes, I remember when I was in high school, and for a nickel, you could get on the streetcar, they would take you clear downtown, and then that was a nickel to get back home. But for $1, you could take a girl to a show downtown. I think it was only 10 cents for a show. Afterwards, you could treat her to dessert or something. I'd take her to a coffee shop, which the coffee was only 5 cents. Well, you're really sending me back in my mind. I should have thought about these things before, but... Oh, there was one place downtown I liked to go, and I liked buttermilk. And for 5 cents, you could drink all the buttermilk you wanted.
Let me ask you about this, because everybody seems to remember something. But December 7th, 1941, do you remember where you were and how you heard that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I was a machinist. I just finished my apprenticeship of being a machinist. I remember them saying about the Japanese. It was a short time after that. The machine shop I worked in was Markey Machinery. They were making things for the merchant ships. And when that was over, well, I lost my job.
And that job carried with it a deferment from military service because it was related to the war effort. We'll come back around to that. But by the time that happened and you went into the Navy, you were already married. So I got to hear, how'd you meet your wife?
You know, I went to a dance out at Angle Lake, and there was a fence around the dance floor, and they had a couple of openings where you bought tickets to dance. And the dance, it cost you 5 cents. And so I had this one ticket, and I was walking around the gate, and I was looking at all the girls to see which girl I should take. But they were all leaning on a fence that was fenced in the dance floor. And all I could see was their backs. And I saw this one cute little girl, and she looked like she should look good when she turned around. I asked this girl to dance, and here it was my wife. I mean, future.
Yeah.
So I danced with her, and I got her phone number and all that. And then I phoned her up, and she was always busy. So one time I phoned her, and she says, yes, I'll go out with you if you take me to a dinner dance. That's where it all started. She liked me, and I liked her.
So the only reason she wanted to go to the dance was so she could wear her sister's fur coat? Is that the truth?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's a good thing that fur coat existed then. It did you a favor. How long was it till you guys got married?
Well, I started to go out with her, and I liked her very much. We'd go out to a place called Angle Lake. I rented a boat, and I said, I want you to row the boat. And so she rowed it out a ways, and I said, well, you can stop here. I said, I got something to give you. And I says, but what I give you, don't drop it. And here I gave her the engagement ring. And here I made her roll the boat out, give her the engagement ring.
And that was smart, because where's she going to go if she's stuck in a boat in the middle of the lake, right?
Well, I just thought it would be something that would be different, you know.
I mean, she couldn't say no. I mean, she's not sure she's going to get back to shore if she says no, right?
Yes. Well, I kind of knew that she would say yes.
So you meet this girl, you get married, you guys even have your first child, you had a son, and then you decided to go in the Navy. What was that about? What encouraged you or convinced you to join the Navy?
When they took away my deferment, well, then I knew I had to join, so I joined the Navy.
So the deferment disappeared, and you knew you had to be in the service somewhere.
Yes, I thought the Navy was the best because my dad was a sailor in Norway and even took one trip to Italy. And they went down there with a lot of lutefisk and that on the boat. And on the way, my dad tattooed his left hand because he was right-handed, but he made a little anchor of a ship. And I always liked that tattoo.
Well, so that had been implanted in your consciousness at a very young age, your dad's anchor tattoo. So the Navy was a natural for you. And we're going to hear about how you ended up on the aircraft carrier, the USS Bunker Hill, which some people have heard about. They know what happened to it at the end of the war. But that wasn't the first assignment the Navy had for you. What'd you do at first?
They called it the Armed Guard. And we went aboard a merchant ship, and we were the gunnery crew. We had a 3-inch cannon. Then we had a lot of machine guns and that along different places on the ship. And we were to protect the ship. I took one trip to Hawaii. Then they sent me to Treasure Island in San Francisco. That's where I got my assignment to this aircraft carrier. They had a busload of sailors. We went down to the pier, and I saw this ship, and it really kind of scared me because it was so big. I took a look at it, and I looked up and up and up and up, and then I finally came up to the flight deck, and my gosh, that ship was so big it scared me, really. But that was my ship. Seeing that I was a machinist, they gave me a pretty good rate right off the start. I was a third-class petty officer, and the first job I had, I really liked, because I went up to officer's country. There was a leak in a pipe up there. Well, here I saw this guy sitting in a chair, and he didn't have any identification on his collar. And so I didn't know what to call him, but I had to have him move. And so I thought, well, quickly I just said, I called him a chief. I said, say, chief, you got to move, because I got to fix this leaking pipe. It's behind your chair. I know that he got up grinning from ear to ear, and I don't know, I think he says, okay, sailor, or something. Then I found out afterwards that was Admiral Mitcher. He was in charge of the whole Fifth Fleet. And I kind of really think that that little story, I bet you he tells that story also, of me calling him a chief.
Well, and good thing he had a sense of humor. Because maybe one of the other admirals would have let you have it, huh?
Well, that could be, but everybody liked Admiral Mitcher anyway. I always remember that he was kind of a small guy. He wasn't a big guy, but I remember when they, right after we got hit by the kamikazes, well, they took him off the ship and placed him elsewhere to operate that area.
And that was May 11th of 1945, but you were on the ship for a while before that. And you mentioned being a machinist. I mean, you're talking about having to fix plumbing leaks. What else were you doing on the ship?
I was in charge of the CO2 shop. I had six guys in my crew, and I would give them jobs of checking all the fire extinguishers and all that on board ship. Seeing I was a machinist, I had a lathe and a drill press and acetylene torches and all that, and I knew how to operate all that. I made jewelry. I would make different things that the other sailors would buy from me so I could send money home to my wife.
You mentioned your wife. So here you are on this ship. You're heading out into the Pacific. Your wife is at home. You've got an infant son at home. Does it ever occur to you that your life is in danger, that there's a chance you might never see your wife or get to see your son grow up?
Yes, but I always remember the day that we got bombed. I was on a night watch. My watch was 3 o'clock in the morning. And shortly after that, we got hit.
As far as your wife and your son, was that something you thought about? I mean, did you live with a fear of not making it back or maybe not surviving this war?
I never thought about I would be killed or anything, but I knew it was dangerous. Oh, I'd like to start down where I saved this guy from Chicago.
Well, and I don't want to miss anything along the way. Before we talk about all that of May 11th off of Okinawa, you also have a battle star. You're wearing it on your hat right now for the Battle of Iwo Jima.
We sent our planes out to bomb Iwo Jima to help the soldiers on the ground. And then when that was secure, well, then we moved to Okinawa. That was the time when we got bombed. They sent out the kamikaze planes.
Yeah, so this is May 11th, 1945 now, and you said you're on a watch. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You had headphones on for what purpose?
I had headphones on because I was in charge of a couple of different areas up there. I had a lot of controls.
And where was this on the ship, where you were?
I was on the second deck down. Our ship got hit by these kamikazes.
What did that feel like where you were?
I was getting a report on my earphones and all that. We shot down one kamikaze and the other two hit the ship. I knew where they had hit because I could hear on my earphones what happened. Oh, I heard this pounding on this escape hatch. And it was from the engine room. And I opened up the escape hatch. And here there was a sailor. He was rum-dum and he wanted to get out. And I tried to help him out, but he was too heavy. And so I saw another sailor walking by. And I asked him to come over and help me. And he helped me get this guy out of this escape hatch. And this sailor told me, he says, you know, he says, there's a first aid station now in the forward part of the ship. I could take this guy up there, and I said, oh, please do. And I gave this guy to take up to the first aid station. Oh, this officer was there, and I heard this pounding on this here hatchway. I wanted to open up this gangway, and this officer was there. He says, don't you touch that. He says, We're to keep everything locked down. And we heard this pounding, and I wanted to open it because there was somebody on the other side wanting to get out. When we did open it, it was a terrible sight. There was a pile of, not just a few guys, but there was guys piled on top of one another. They'd come to the end of the driveway. I guess they couldn't see, but they had an object to climb over, and then they'd die on top. But we did open the door, the hatchway. There was a pile of sailors dead, not just one or two, but I would say there was five or six on top of one another trying to get further on.
And so people understand, you wanted to open it because you know there's someone there, but they wouldn't let you because of the fire risk? Was that the issue?
Or the explosion.
So you could, by trying to save them, you could kill a whole bunch more.
Yes, the officer wouldn't let me open up that hatch until things quieted down.
War puts young men in situations no one should ever have to face. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old Al Skerritt. Check out the photos of him online at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you can also link to a book about the attack on the USS Bunker Hill. That book would end up connecting Al to that disoriented sailor he saved from the engine room 72 years ago. We'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.